D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.
Und am Mikrofon ist Katrin Ohlendorf. Guten Tag. Die Chemie als Forschungszweig, wie wir ihn heute kennen, ist schon mehrere hundert Jahre alt. Chemische Forschung und chemische Industrie haben unsere Art zu leben, unseren Alltag, unseren Lebensstandard von Grund auf geprägt und werden es ganz sicher auch weiterhin tun. Zum Beispiel in der Schlüsselfrage nach der Speicherung von Energie, dem Nadelöhr, wenn es um den Ausbau regenerativer Energie geht. Da wird dieser Fach- und Industriebereich eine große Rolle spielen. Die Chemie, so sagt der amerikanische Chemiker und Harvard-Professor George Whitesides, einer der meistzitiertesten Chemiker unserer Zeit, steht vor großen Herausforderungen und Chancen. Gesundheit, Energiefragen und Nachhaltigkeit, all diese Felder unterlägen einer dramatischen Umwälzung und böten Unmengen an neuen Anwendungsbereichen. Auf der anderen Seite aber sieht er die Chemie in einer Art Krise. Er beobachtet einen Rückgang entscheidender Erfindungen in der chemischen oder auch der pharmazeutischen Industrie. Wie sieht die Zukunft der Chemie also aus, fragt er und hat einige Antworten auf diese Fragen parat, für die er aus seinem breiten Erfahrungsfundus als Forscher, aber auch als Unternehmer in dem Bereich schöpft. In seinem Keynote-Vortrag Reinventing Chemistry, also Chemie neu erfinden, den er im Rahmen der ersten Herrenhäuser-Konferenz zu Nanowissenschaften der Volkswagen-Stiftung gehalten hat, wagte er einen Blick in die Zukunft seiner Disziplin. Aufgezeichnet wurde der Vortrag am 12. Dezember 2012.
Yesterday I was in Washington talking about, among other things, the question of what one does in terms of using federal support for science to generate a outcome which is useful to society. How do you do that and what form should it take? And it's an interesting subject because it touches on nano, which has been a major focus of science and technology in universities for the last period of time. An enormous focus in the microelectronics industry, and the recipient of a great deal of money and very clever effort. The question that's now coming up is, what's come of it? And I'm not going to answer that question, but what I am going to do is to speak to you half from the perspective of science and half from the perspective of public policy on the questions of how, in the United States, we are beginning to rethink this question. Because we have, for better or worse, decided that the present system is not working all that well. So it's a time of real change, and it's going to be very interesting. Now, this talk is titled Reinventing Chemistry, but I should say that the subject matter, in large part, doesn't have anything to do with chemistry specifically. It does have to do with chemistry materials, condensed matter physics, some biology. That is, it's small science as opposed to accelerator science or as opposed to astronomy. So it's that kind of thing. So it's relevant to the subject of the discussion. Let me start with some facts. And these, interestingly, apply across many disciplines at this point. Over the last 20 years, the jobs classified as being chemical jobs in the United States have decreased by 300,000. A corresponding number is that in the last decade, the number of jobs in the pharmaceutical industry have decreased by about 300,000. And both of those represent largely jobs in the research and development sector, defined in some fashion. And we'll talk about why that is in a bit. But this doesn't sound terrific. And a question that you can ask about chemistry, about material science, about whatever you like, is, are jobs going down because those industries are essentially going out of business? That is, they've solved all the problems there are to solve, and right now they're just going to become manufacturing entities, and there's nothing more that's going to happen. Now, I'm going to start with a sort of our exam, and this is only half humorous. The first question is, for 60%, recreate the world of chemicals and derived materials using only CO2, H2, heat, and electrons. The second is trace a mechanistic pathway from ions and neurotransmitters to the Brahm Requiem and explain the reaction of the audience. And the third is to sequester unlimited quantities of CO2 and provide unlimited power and water with a guaranteed 20% after-tax return on investment using no equipment not readily available in Haiti or Somalia. The question is, can you do those? Because those are all real questions. And the answer is no, of course we can't do them. But they represent, in a fashion that's only half jocular, something which we really have to do. We have to recreate, find ways of recreating our industrial base in chemistry. We have to understand how the mind thinks in some broad sense, and we have to understand how to deal with the problems of sustainability in the environment. I'm just going to show you a couple of pictures, and I'm going to return to some of these in a bit more detail, but they'll give you a sense for the answer to the question of, is there anything left to do? This chart is one of my favorite charts. It comes from a Department of Energy website, and it basically shows on the left-hand side the sources of energy: petroleum, natural gas, coal, nuclear, solar, wind, geothermal, whatever. And over here are the sinks. These are the uses. And the details of this are, in a sense, neither here nor there. There are one or two things that are worthwhile picking out at the beginning, one of them being that about 85% of the world's energy right now is generated by burning something. And that's not going to change very rapidly. The second is that about 50% of the energy that comes out of this side is lost somewhere in the process of getting to that side. That is an opportunity. There's probably a lot that can be done there. But what I tell my friends and students is that what they should do is to copy this chart, and then where you normally look at your own picture in the morning when you're brushing your teeth, paste this chart up and look at it, because it's actually more interesting, and it certainly is going to teach you more. What I can say about this is that we don't have any idea how to manage that kind of system. We don't know what to do with that. Here's another question of the same sort. This is actually the largest financial question in the United States. You have your problems in Europe, we have ours, and this is the biggest one of these. It's the cost of healthcare. Cost of healthcare presently is about 18% of the gross domestic product, and there's a very interesting set of numbers here. Actually, these are remarkably instructive. On this axis, you have average life expectancy taken, I think, completely inappropriately as a measure of quality of healthcare. Now, let's not worry about whether that's right or wrong. And then the dark blue line here is the expenditures per person per year in various countries, ranging from Japan to something over there, Portugal. And there are two things that you notice. The one that I like the most is that the United States spends about $7,500 per person per year. Cuba spends asymptotically close to zero, and the lifespan is exactly the same. What one infers from that is that you know at the very beginning that there's no correlation between lifespan and expenditure. The more interesting thing is that no matter how much you spend, you live about the same. Japanese live a little bit longer, people in Portugal a little bit less. But the conclusion from that could be that the medical system doesn't actually do anything, which I think is largely correct. And it has some very important consequences for thinking about how you do stuff. Those are practical questions. Here's an intellectual problem. What's life? We have no idea what life is. We really have no conceptual basis for thinking about what life is. And that, this to me, in a slightly more elaborate form, is probably the most interesting intellectual question that I know for this century. And then there are a series of social problems that are both intellectual and practical. One of them has to do with the management of what we have come to call megacities. And a megacity is a city with population broadly greater than 50 million people. Mumbai, Shanghai, there are a couple of others. Mexico City is getting there pretty rapidly. And if you think about this in terms of mass transport of goods and water and food in, energy in, the flow of epidemics, the educational process, the flow of waste out, it's an enormously interesting, complicated systems problem which we do not know how to deal with. We have no idea how to deal with a problem of that complexity. So, you know, these are just examples of problems which to me say there's no shortage of problems. So how is it that technical people who can solve the problems are being laid off by the hundreds of thousands? How does that work? Well, there's another take on this. And in 2007, a few years ago, but the problems haven't changed, I found myself by accident in Avignon in a meeting of ethicists who were concerned with the ethics of nanotechnology. We rapidly reached the conclusions there were no perceptible ethical problems in nanotechnology. There are some practical problems, but nothing else. But what was surprising was that the group, failing anything else to do, was thinking about where the sciences and ethics did come together. And we're thinking about these sorts of questions. What are the biggest ethical problems facing science, society, who's responsible for them, and who's obliged to do what for whom? And if you look at the list of big problems that comes out of that discussion and out of other discussions, I don't think we would probably disagree on these questions very much. We might disagree on the precise phrasing, but for example, climate variability is really a problem in global stewardship. We occupy the planet, how do we keep it in one piece? Water and energy, standard of living. I mean, you can't have a standard of living. You don't live if you don't have water and energy. That's simply the way the world works. Sustainability is the obligations to our grandchildren. Healthcare is a social problem in equity and justice. How do we distribute the benefits of a technological society across all of the world's population? Globalization, very interesting problems related to this, but also how much in the developed world are we willing to pay in terms of standard of living in order to distribute part of that more broadly? Developing countries, jobs, I'm going to return to this in a bit. So these are a bunch of problems, and also at the same time there were a bunch of major issues which are in a sense intellectual. What is life? How does the mind think? How do we think about systems of energy and water in the environment? How do we think about complexity and emergence, as in megacities? These are all really interesting, good, serious problems for which science can't answer the story. But the point of concern with those is that if you look at them, they're all basically about what I'm going to loosely call chemistry. And the point that came up, to everyone's surprise, I will say, was that the argument emerged that in the period between perhaps 1900 and World War II, the world basically belonged to nuclear physics, or to physics. Quantum mechanics was what changed the world. After World War II, in the period between World War II and 2000, there were three major technological drivers. One of them was nuclear weapons, which basically set the tone of interactions of nations with one another. One was information technology, and one was arguably the deciphering of the genome and understanding the nature of inheritance in that sense. Of those, information technology has been enormously important, nuclear weapons have been enormously important, genomics has not been enormously important so far, but it may turn out to be so in the future. I think it probably will. And all of those are problems that are now past the problems at this point, sustainability, healthcare, things of this sort, they're all chemistry. So chemistry was sort of the last of the story in the earlier part of last century. It's now right in the center, and yet people are being laid off. So is it because chemistry and associated areas have not been successful? And the answer to that is also no. I mean, complex synthesis, unbelievable skill in deciphering complex structures, catalysis, pharmaceuticals, single molecule spectroscopy, exhaust catalyst. One can go on and on and on with wonderful discoveries. So it's been technically very successful. So what's the problem? And in fact, is there a problem? Now, let's talk about, is there a problem? And the answer is there is. But the problem is more complicated than one might think. One part of the problem is capitalism. And I'm a hardcore capitalist, but there are a bunch of problems with capitalism, particularly in the American style of capitalism, which has the characteristic that it recognizes financial, not social, return. So we live in a system which, in the Goldman Sachs view of accounting, assigns effectively no value to long term. And I'll come back to that, but that's simply the way it is. So it doesn't assign a social or societal return, it assigns actually a negative value to long term research. That is to say, research is regarded not as an investment in the future, but as an expense that could be returned to stockholders. And so if you have an active research program, your stock goes down as a consequence. There are a series of things that happen in which capitalism follows wealth. So right now, capital is moving out of US, Europe, and Japan into China. So capitalism follows that, and that has major effects. And then we had something which was technologically pretty interesting called the Cold War. And it's now been replaced by what's referred to in Washington as the Long War. The planning cycles assume that the Middle East instabilities and related things in Africa and Indonesia and places like that will go on for about 100 years. So that we're in for a very long haul of a very different sort of conflict. And again, I'll return to that. Then there's an issue in globalization and jobs. The lowest cost provider wins. And information technology has dramatically raised productivity while decreasing the number of jobs. That's an interesting problem. Then we have a problem which is one of the ones that I'm addressing here, which is universities, which have historically since World War II, served the purpose of being sources of new ideas. But we've gotten stuck in this issue of curiosity versus utility. We've gotten stuck on the idea of curiosity. And we've also gotten stuck in something that doesn't turn out to work very well, which is the apprentice model. That is, we treat students as apprentices, not as future scientists. And you can make some real arguments about that. Again, I return. Now, let me talk about, briefly, the question of what the influence is of declining research investment in companies on the field of chemistry. Chemistry and related areas have been almost unique in the very close connection between universities and industry. And we've had a model for this which isn't quite right. The model has been universities think up ideas and then industry commercializes them. It's actually, there are three players: government, which provides money for the university; government regulates and taxes industry. But whereas the university has this idea of teaching and research as our business with a model which is fundamentally not changed since Liebig invented it, which involves a professor assigning a problem to a student who is fundamentally an apprentice, meaning that the student is being trained to be like the professor. Not the right thing to do. And then out of that comes a problem or a thesis. And this has led to a bunch of stuff, knowledge and people. Industry, it is claimed, does development, manufacturing, distribution, and so on. But if you look at the characteristic inventions of each of these, it is true that quantum mechanics and crystallography and restriction endonucleases and so on were originated in university. It is also true that if you look through what happened in industry, ROMP, a Nobel Prize, was actually invented and commercialized in industry. Asymmetric epoxidation was invented and commercialized in industry in a slightly different form. Super acids came out of Giorgio Alla looking at cracking towers and simply working backwards. NMR was invented here, but in fact it would never have made any impression had it not been for Bruker and Varian commercializing these devices. The point of this is that the flow back and forth between the two has been enormously, enormously useful. The interplay between the practical and the curiosity-driven. And as this sector goes out of the business of coming up with new things, then the flow doesn't work that way. It's really terrible for the field. All right, for those of you who are students, you can forget about the rest of the talk. This is the one slide you should remember. Because this is the generic slide of time and risk discounted cash flow, and it's the way the world operates now. And without going through any details, if you have a research problem, you spend money on it. And if you're doing an accounting of this, what you do is to assume that you're borrowing the money, it accumulates, and you pay interest on it. So the interest rate is important. And the time that you have to borrow it is important. You make a product, the product produces income. At some point, the accumulated integrated return, the in from sale of product, equals the out from all of these expenditures, and you go cash flow neutral, and after that you make a profit. The point of interest here is that the longer the time between here and here, the more interest you pay, That's bad. The longer the time between here and here, the less certain it is that what you invent over here will turn out to be useful over here, so that you discount both time and cost of capital, based on both time and cost of capital. And if you do the calculation now, you can very rapidly convince yourself that for a large company, there is no longer any sustainable economic justification for doing long-term research. And in fact, they're all getting out. If you look at what's happening even in the pharmaceutical industry, you pick up the newspaper and Novartis has left off 5,000 people or Roche has left off 10,000. The reason for that is that, in fact, and these are complicated issues, there's nothing simple, and I don't disagree with the answer, but it is so expensive to do research, to borrow money to do it, that unless you're able to deal with this equation in ways that most large companies are not, can't do it. And you say, well, surely you can figure out how to manage this by being smart about your choice of problems. But I remind you that the boards of directors of most large companies are entirely financial or human relations. There is very seldom anyone who comes with a technical background in a large company. Now, if you talk to big companies, and this is again not criticizing, I'm just trying to explain what's going on. Every large company will say, oh, we're in the business of innovation. We're going to innovate, we're going to innovate, we're going to innovate. New products. And then you say, good, we like that. You know, I'm in the business of innovation too. What is your criterion for innovation? They say, we have lots of money, we're going to innovate. You say, yes, yes, but a little more detail, please. So they say, the only thing you have to have, the only thing we have to know, is that within 18 months, we will have $300 million a year in return on top line. That's all we have to have. And that's, of course, impossible. It just can't be done. You can't go from zero to $300 million in 18 months. And I have here a wonderful chart. And this just happened to be one that was sent to me, but it's entirely appropriate for this discussion. These are timelines for the commercialization of MEMS and related technologies. And MEMS, if you have a cell phone in your cell phone, there'll be a half a dozen MEMS devices, the accelerometers and things like that that tell you where it is and measure how it's being moved, are all MEMS. And MEMS are now used in pressure sensors for airbags and accelerometers, gas sensors, nozzles, radio frequency devices, so on. What is the average time between discovery and full-scale commercial production? And the answer is almost 30 years. And there's some of those numbers. Where's the one that I like? Here, oscillators, 46 years. That is to say, in this kind of technology, as it's being done right now, if you invent something in your 20s, there's a reasonable chance you won't live long enough to see it get there, even if it's wildly successful. And think about that from the point of view of microelectronics. Microelectronics, the transistor was really late 40s, but early 50s, and it's taken 60 years to get to the point where it has transformed the world, but these are slow. So I don't see a simple way of fixing this problem. Now, one of the Avignon questions was a question of obligation. And particularly in university, we tend to think that money rains gently from heaven and it comes from, who knows? You know, it just comes. It comes from the Volkswagen Stiftung. Terrific idea. It actually doesn't. It actually comes from taxpayers. And the taxpayers very reluctantly pay taxes because they have no choice, which goes to government. And the government takes a tiny fraction of that, gives it to universities. The universities in this model come up with new ideas which go to corporations. And I say this because actually universities have no way of commercializing anything. And then corporations make products which benefit taxpayers. That's the way it works. But in university, we tend to forget that we do have an obligation to the people who pay the bills. We don't like thinking about it, but we should do that. And then there's one last issue in chemistry, condensed matter physics, things of this sort, which I think is beautifully captured by this quote from Bill Bryson, who's a humorous polymath. He says, physicists are notoriously, actually Pauly said, physicists are notoriously scornful of scientists from other fields, that's true. When the wife of the great Austrian physicist Wolfgang Pauli left him for a chemist, he was staggered with disbelief. Had she taken a bullfighter, I would have understood, he remarked in wonder to a friend, but a chemist? Now, the point of this is that the area in which we work, which does real stuff, tends not to be too inflated about what it does. We tend to be pretty modest. And so you ask a chemist what he does, and he'll tell you that he makes paint. And that's not the same thing as understanding the inner psychological secrets and social dynamics of black holes.
Die Zukunft der chemischen Forschung und Industrie, das ist heute unser Thema hier im D-Radio-Wissen-Hörsaal. Der amerikanische Chemiker und Professor an der Harvard-Universität George Whitesides schildert gerade die Herausforderungen und Chancen für seine Disziplin und beantwortet nun die Frage, wie die sich in Zukunft aufstellen, was sie leisten muss.
D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.
So, we're now beginning to rethink how we do stuff. And one of the several intellectual structures that's being used is what's called Pasteur's quadrant. And the idea is the following. One makes a 2x2 plot. I'm going to return to another 2x2 plot at the end. And my quadrants are going to be here high and low on the scale of quest for fundamental understanding, that is knowledge generation, or utility, consideration of use, high and low. And each of these quadrants is given a name, and the Bohr quadrant is arguably for pure basic research, whatever that means. And the Edison quadrant is for pure applied research. Edison put every possible kind of thing in a heated bulb to see if it would give off light. And this is commonly attributed to industry, this is commonly attributed to university. But there are two other sectors that are interesting. One is the so-called Pasteur quadrant. And Pasteur was basically the inventor of microbiology and also one of the very first people to do vaccination. Enormously important, both because they solved problems in food safety and disease and because they invented new fields. So the argument is, why should universities do just this and industry do just that? Why shouldn't we all be doing that? And that's what we're beginning to think about now. It's not trivial to do it, but I think it's going to be much more rewarding. I should point out that this cycle, this quadrant in Washington is fairly frequently referred to as the university quadrant because it is low in quest for fundamental understanding and low in utility at the same time. That's not a good idea. All right, so there are two ways of thinking about Pasteur's quadrant. The way that it's often done is to say, well, all this is up here is taking old science and using it to figure out how to make slightly better products. I think the much better way of doing it is to think about it as being a way of looking at problems like managing megacities, managing the healthcare system, dealing with vaccination in new ways, whatever, and using those problems, which we cannot presently solve, to stimulate the production of fundamentally new areas of science. If you can do that, you really make a big difference. Terrific. And when I talk about this, there's always something that comes up that says, someone comes up and says, well, what about quantum mechanics? And that's right. Quantum mechanics was the result of pure intellectual curiosity, in a sense, and it transformed the world. Absolutely. It was also a pretty much unique event. It happened once in the last century. And so it can't be used as an example. And one of the things that you might think about is this question of, if you're going to use the idea that science should be an art form, as ballet is an art form, then a question that you should ask is, if society is going to regard science as an art form, probably society will pay for science as an art form. And the amount of money that goes into ballet is not enough to keep any laboratory of anyone in this group in business for a week. So you can't have it both ways. So then what we're beginning to move to, or at least try to think about, is an answer to this question. Should we have something in which there's application-driven stuff that should dominate, or curiosity, knowledge-driven stuff, or is it possible to do both? And I'm going to argue that in all of the big questions, it's possible to do both. And let me just take a couple of examples. These are going to be very quick. But here is something, this is the healthcare problem, in which there's a very, very interesting opportunity to build a high technology base for what is effectively public health. And to extend that at the same time into developing medicine for the developing world, where cost is critically important. That's a utilitarian statement of the problem. At the same time, if you ask what the technology is that's going to work here, it's going to involve an enormously interesting and complicated series of problems in which information becomes a critical part of medical science. It is not critically at this point. So one can imagine a medicine which now finally connects to information, in which we talk about epidemiology reasonably, we understand what the relation is between the genome and occupational exposures and health styles and things of this sort. We don't understand any of that stuff at the moment. So it's very, very interesting from the point of view of science as well. And I'm going to return to this with a personal example at the end. This one, the utility is obvious, but thinking about this from the vantage of what would be a systems analytic method that would enable us to really understand, do we want to, for example, spend money on silicon solar, which is somewhere up there? The world has decided that photovoltaics are a good idea. It's absolutely not clear that photovoltaics are a good idea. I think you can make an argument that they're probably a bad idea. But we have dived into this because we haven't basically thought through the problem. What's the science that's needed to think through the problem? Megacities. We talked about this briefly. Utility is again obvious, but understanding the problems of that many people, mass transport, all the rest of it, one can imagine putting together something that is a kind of statistical mechanics of very large numbers of people. And in fact, the sociologists are getting interested in this from a very fundamental level. So it's both. What is life? The simple way of phrasing this question is antivirus. That's an intellectual statement. We know that this is alive. We know that this is made up of a series of reactions. This is just a section of a metabolic chart. So each of these points is a compound, and it's connected by reactions. We know the compounds are not alive. We know the reactions are not alive, but the collections of compounds and reactions is alive. How does that happen? No idea. None. No way of even thinking about it. An enormously interesting problem. And then a very local problem, if you think about why a drug binds to a protein, we think about this in terms of interaction, lock and key, right shape of the drug, the right shape of the lock. It's looking more and more as if that has probably very little to do with it, and what's happening is simply that you have water inside the cavity of the lock. That water is energetically unfavorable with respect to bulk water, and when you stick a ligand in there of roughly the right shape, it displaces it. So we've had something in which the most important liquid on the planet, we don't even begin to understand it at a scientific level. So extremely interesting stuff. So what we say is that we have very important problems, both practically and intellectually, and we're not prospering, the sciences are not prospering as they should, as a key part of the problem-solving apparatus for society. So what are we going to do? Are we going to have more of the same? Or are we going to have a revolution? And let's talk for just a moment about what a revolution is. What makes for revolutions in science? And if you talk to people who are philosophers or historians of science, there are a variety of answers. Let me just tell you what two of them are because they're relevant. The one that's probably most familiar is due to Thomas Kuhn, whose very, very famous book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, was based on the idea of quantum mechanics. He was a physicist. And what he said is that scientists are just like everybody else. You know, you work for a living, you get up in the morning, and you go to work. And having a revolution is really, really hard work, so you will do anything to avoid it, anything to avoid thinking. But every once in a while, you find that you have observations which simply don't agree with theory. And after you've tried every possible way you can to get out of it, the black lines in the Balmer spectrum, you have to throw away the theory and do something new. So His view of revolutions comes when there are data which are fundamentally incompatible with theory of the time. And he makes a very interesting distinction between what he calls a puzzle and what he calls a problem. A puzzle is what he says that 99.9% of scientists do. And the characteristics of a puzzle is that it's something you work on where you know the answer before you start, you know there is an answer, you know how to get to the answer, nobody cares about the answer, but you do because it's sort of fun to do. And the alternative, which is this revolutionary stuff, which is hard to do, is it's really important, you don't know if there's an answer, you have no idea how to get there, and people really care. That's a problem. So, you know, it's an interesting view. The second view is that this is due to, among other things, Freeman Dyson, Peter Galison, and others, that what really makes for revolutions is tools, and as an example, you can argue that nanotechnology was founded on the scanning tunneling microscope or scanning probe microscopes. There were other things that were there, but that was what was perceived to open the door. So when you have a new tool, you can make new observations, and with new observations, you can do wonderful things. Okay, so let me now briefly talk about three problems just as illustrations. And one of these is going to be nothing to do with us, and two will come from our own research. So I'm going to talk just for a moment about the utilization of CO2, for another moment about developing world and point-of-care diagnostics, and another about soft robotics. And all of these are chemical problems. All right, CO2. We have a system now in which we start from reduced hydrocarbon and air, and by combining these in various ways, either to generate heat or to do chemical reactions, we can strip hydrogens away from this to make more oxidized skeletons, and then add oxygens to make the intermediates and compounds that become the basis for the commodity chemical industry. Arguably, in the future, we're going to have something that the world has never seen before, which is a pure form of carbon with a negative value. That means that somebody will actually pay you to take it away. That's not the case now, but you can imagine that to be the case. And if your carbon source is free, then you can use a more expensive reducing agent, maybe solar, maybe in that application, maybe a nuclear reactor to supply electrons, and go to here. So that you can imagine starting from the most oxidized species and reducing it, as opposed to starting from the most reduced species and oxidizing it. What is our scientific base for this? And it is asymptotically close to zero. I mean, basically, nobody's worked on this problem for about 100 years. So there's a challenge. And there's no reason why you can't make carbon-carbon bonds here and build molecules. It's just that chemists haven't tried to do it. Here's the second example, healthcare. And I'm going to talk about this from one perspective, which is the question of how you do diagnosis, either here, point of care, or in the developing world at zero cost. It's a problem that we've been working on for a couple of years. Here's what the product is. The product is a paper chip in which, as I'll show you in a moment, you put a drop of blood on the back. The fluid wicks its way through, turns colors, and it gives you, in this case, a diagnosis of liver function. What's interesting about this is that, without going through all the details, to go from the first demonstrations to this in field trials has been 4 years, which is dramatically, dramatically fast for a medical product. And it was done because we focused on making it cheap, and because it was cheap, it had to be simple. Because it was cheap and simple, it could go fast. Now, it also turns out to make some very interesting new capability. And here is one. We have worked in conventional microfluidics for years, but this came as a surprise. What I show you here is a piece of paper, and we use paper because it's so readily available, patterned into regions that are hydrophobic and then regions that are hydrophilic. And these are just spots of dye to show what goes on. If you take a bunch of these with patterns in them and you intersperse them with what is, at least initially, a literally double-sided carpet tape with holes punched in, follow what goes on, let's say, with this red dot. We put a drop of liquid here, it goes through that hole into this, capillary wicking carries it to there, it goes through that hole into that, that wicks into four spots, each of those goes through there, each of those wicks into four,
each of those goes to that and wicks into the proper number. What you can do this way, then, is to take a 50 microliter sample of blood, get 25 microliters of serum out of it, and distribute it, in this case, into 1,000 wells, roughly 1,000 wells over there, for multiplexed analysis at zero cost, plus or minus a little bit. This has the potential to be really, really interesting and important. Whether it'll work, I don't know, but we've gone a long way. So the test here involves a drop of blood. You put it on one side, a filter filters out erythrocytes, the serum goes through, it turns color. So that's an example of using a problem that's practical to develop a technology that has the characteristic that it's very broadly generalizable. Let me talk about another problem, which is robots. Now, robots is a very tricky subject. So if you go to the Volkswagen plant, you will find endless robots. These robots are basically us with arms that move very fast and will pick up a frame or whatever it is, and you do not want to get in the way of one of these when it's moving things because they're not designed for that purpose. They cut you in half. So we're interested in robots, and you say, why are we interested in robots? And the answer is that if you look, I think, at the real competition between nations now, we're not competing for raw materials, we're not competing for resources, we're actually competing for jobs, because jobs are what give our young people futures. And so why bring in robots? And the answer is they're going to come. What they have the potential to do is to increase the capability of human beings so that we can do things that you couldn't do, we as people couldn't do otherwise. And US and Europe has prospered by creating new job categories. And this is an example of a new job category. Every research program should have an animal as its totem. And this is ours. This is the animal that we admire. And doesn't look like a dog or a horse or something like that. I'll show you one of those in a moment. But this is a wonderful, wonderful creature. This is an octopus, obviously. And the entire of that octopus is going to get through that hole, which is not the size of the octopus. It has a brain that's quite squishy, so it can squeeze the brain through. And here it's pulling the rest of the octopus through. It's gotten the brain through. The eyes are also quite deformable. And so there it tugs on whatever part of the octopus is left back there. And pop, out it comes. And look at the look of satisfaction. This is a very satisfied robot. We don't have robots to do that. I mean, robots look like this. And this is another picture that all of you should remember because there's something called the Turing test. And the Turing test is a test which was designed by Mr. Turing of computer fame to answer the question of when can you tell that a computer has become intelligent? And the answer in the Turing test is you sit on one side of a screen and type. The computer sits on the other side and types, or a person sits on the other side, and if you can't tell whether it's a person or a computer, that's as far as you'll ever go. You can't tell. I can't tell that any of you are alive, to be honest. I mean, I think so, but I don't know that. I have no existential proof of that. So here is a device which, to me, passes the Turing test in terms of motion. This is made by Boston Dynamics, and what I want you to know as you watch this thing recover from this kick, is that there's no brain there. That's all reflux from accelerometers and things of that sort. And it's run by a 50 horsepower, basically lawnmower engine, so it's much less efficient than a horse. But, on the other hand, you know, this really does pretty amazingly well. And if you combine that with what's coming out of computer science and deep learning and some of these artificial algorithms, what we're going to find is marriages of mechanical and information systems which are going to be very hard to tell from animals. Watch this slip. Oh, you know, I can't tell that it's not alive. Okay. Now, what we've been working on is a different class. This is squid generated. And I'm just going to show you two examples of this. This is a gripper. And there's a string up here. But this is more interesting than it seems. That's a raw egg down there. And what one is doing here is to have this thing actuated by pressure. It's pneumatically driven. Because it's pneumatically driven, a very simple controller enables it to distribute pressure over things like eggs or mice or soft objects. And it gives an almost fail-proof mechanism of doing soft gripping. Here is another example of how that kind of thing is interesting. Where are we here? And if you take a traditional hard robot and you abuse it, it breaks. So let's abuse this. I mean, it hurts to watch it and to show you that it's real. And now what happens? And what happens is it works just fine. So you can drive cars over this. They're essentially indestructible in certain kinds of things. So they do stuff that you can't really do. And then finally, just to make the case that they can even move rapidly. So you get the point. Now, the issue here is that these are technological things that are interesting, but they also turn out to be extremely interesting problems in material science, because the characteristics that give them the responses they do are very non-linear responses to pressure activation in a material that shows snap-through instabilities. It's terrific stuff, and it's going to displace, I think, a broad range of very expensive controllers. So what happens is that by getting interested in a practical problem, you come to something that is at the same time really good science. So what do we do? So the situation we're in right now is some of the most important problems in society are not being worked on, and they depend upon chemistry in allied areas. The solutions to these problems require chemistry, and we desperately need new chemistry, both in technology and in terms of ideas. But chemistry, you know, this is the Bryson thing. We're very modest, and we're intellectually risk-averse. Financial return has come to dominate industry, and teaching focuses on the past. So we've got to fix some things. Universities have to lead the change, have to, because industry must live with capitalism. There really isn't much choice in that. And government has a whole bunch of things that it has to fix. It's not really very flexible. So the university is the only participant that has some flexibility in what it can do. Solutions, we have to change our definition of what chemistry is. We have to teach for breadth and creativity. Right now, we teach from textbooks which are designed to sell to the broadest possible audience. Textbooks actually hold us back because they're intended to dumb down things. We have to learn how to kill old fields, you know, just cut their throats and start over. We have to learn how to do collaborative R&D, not because of the collaborative is industrially relevant, but because we teach one another something. And then we have to put the poetry back. I'll come to that in just a moment. I want to finish with that, but let me just give you one example, since those of you who are in the room are either often students or something else. Here we have a carboxylic acid giving a carboxylate, which we know happens because this is acidic, because that's resonance stabilized. That's what we tell the students. It's wrong. It doesn't have anything to do with that. It has to do with the fact that there's a carbonyl. The carbonyl is electron withdrawing, and you can basically get the same result by putting two non-conjugated oxygens here. We say that benzene is stable because of something called delocalization. Well, no, it's probably stabilized because it's a bunch of sp square bonds. They're strong bonds, but it's the sigma framework that makes it stable, not the pi framework. And you could go on and make this case, but this basic point that textbooks are designed to sell, not to help students learn, is critically important. The web will fix that, is fixing it, but it's going to take a while. So we need to reinvent education, and we need actually to start teaching those of you who are young something rather than just letting you slide through. So you should actually learn about solvation and thermo and stat mech and applied math and all the rest of that. And then at the graduate level, this idea that I got a problem from my thesis director 50 years ago, and I'm going to give you a minor modification of it, and you're going to do that for 50 years, and we will propagate this kind of Lamarckian intellectual blind spot forever and ever and ever is clearly a terrible, terrible idea. So, two final things. One is for the students, and this is the question of risk. When I go through this harangue with my students, what they say is, "Ah, this is all terrific, you're old, you've gotten through by whatever series of tricks you got through, but we're not going to do that, we have jobs that we've got to get." And I want to do a Bain 2x2 matrix analysis, game theoretic analysis of success. And this is going to be straightforward. I'm going to take problems in two classes, either important problems or unimportant problems, and I'm going to assume you start off and you're either successful in solving it or not. And let's look at the outcomes. You have an important problem when you solve it, you get a lot of credit. That's pretty clear. You got an unimportant problem and you fail to solve it, you get no credit, and that's pretty clear. So the diagonal terms are not interesting. It's the off-diagonal terms. If you take an unimportant problem and you solve it, you still don't get any credit because nobody cares. So if you take an important problem and you don't solve it, you get credit because at least you've opened a door. So theoretically, what you want to do is go for important problems. Don't go for problems that you can solve. The risk is to be conservative, not to take a chance. Now, yeah, I'd forgotten about this. I put this in because it's relevant to this talk. Technology transfer. Part of the issue that one has to think about is that we in universities invent ideas, and the real world wants what's called a product. And a product is a solution to a problem. People who are solving problems do not care about technology. They want the technology to disappear. People who are making technology do not care about the product because they're not actually interested in doing anything that's very interesting. They're interested in making papers. So you've got a real issue here. Industry is not interested in developing science into products, and university researchers are not interested in making products. So there's a great gap there. And I think we're beginning to work through in the United States how to bridge that. We had a method called venture capital that's collapsed. We need another one, and that's beginning to emerge. But I just pointed out to you as something which will have, I think, a different solution in Europe. But it deals with something which Peter Gerlitz pointed out to me called the Anna Karenina effect. The Anna Karenina effect, you say, what on earth does Anna Karenina have to do with technology transfer? And the answer is the following, this opening line which you're all familiar with, all happy families are alike, each unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. What this means is that any bit of science you do in a university has to go through a series of maybe 50 gates, regulatory, cost, manufacturing, invention, intellectual property, all the rest of this stuff, to become successful. And all successful companies have done that, the most successful products. I mean, they've solved all those problems. But for any new technology, there are probably 50 combinatorial ways of failing. And we explore each of them, and it just is very inefficient. So we need to find some way of going through this more efficiently. Now let me just finish with this one last thing, because I think it's actually extremely important. And this is the issue of poetry. Because so long as we think of the sciences like chemistry as being just making paint and soap, we're really doing ourselves and society a harm. Because what we're saying is that we're a minor player in little bits of technology that don't count. And I urge you to think about the following test. It's one that I use in Cambridge in cocktail parties. The Cambridge cocktail parties can be mind-burningly boring. And if you want to clear the table around you, there are a couple of ways of doing it. One that I use is to say that I think the world is a much better place for the existence of nuclear weapons. And when I look up, everybody's gone. So that works pretty well. But when somebody says to you, what do you do as a chemist? And you say, I make statins. Statins block HMG-CoA reductase and act as anti-inflammatories. They are a major source of sales for the pharmaceutical industry. They're gone. I mean, they really don't care. On the other hand, if you say, statins change the way we die, then people pay attention. And what we need to do is to think about what we do in those terms, not in terms of paint and soap. Thank you very much.
Die Chemie muss sich verändern, wenn sie auch in Zukunft einen Beitrag zur Lösung gesellschaftlicher Herausforderungen leisten will, sagt George Whitesides, renommierter US-amerikanischer Chemiker und Harvard-Professor. Reinventing Chemistry hieß sein Vortrag, den wir eben gehört haben. Aufgenommen wurde der am 12. Dezember 2012 und zwar im Rahmen der ersten Herrenhäuser-Konferenz zu Nanowissenschaften, die von der Volkswagen-Stiftung in Hannover veranstaltet wurde.
D-Radio Wissen. Hörsaal.